Hello, this is Wendy Bauer reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review, April 3rd, 2017. And we'll begin our reading from the front page. Tony Reed writes from Pena, "Cause of Pena fire that killed baby, toddler, under investigation." A house fire tragedy in Pena early Sunday that claimed the lives of a baby and a toddler has shocked the community and left some neighbors feeling nervous. And while there is nothing to suggest Sunday's fire at 808 East 2nd Street was anything but a tragic accident, it comes in the wake of a spate of arson fires that began burning back in the summer. The alarm was raised on Sunday's fire at 5:43 a.m., and heroic rescue efforts by a Pena police officer at first, and then Pena firefighters, were initially beaten back by the intense heat and smoke. The police officer had been on the scene within a minute and was told the children were inside by family members. Firefighters later recovered the bodies of a 3-month-old baby and a 2-year-old from the ruins of the 2-story older home. Firefighters said the father of the children had suffered significant burns from his own attempt to rescue them, and the children's mother was also injured, but less severely. They were both being treated in Springfield Memorial Hospital later Sunday. Their home is expected to be a total loss, and the American Red Cross is assisting the parents, who also have support from an extensive, wider family. Authorities are withholding the names of the family. Neighbor Jeremy Durbin, who lives barely a block away, said the amount of fires in Pena is unnerving, with a total of 7 arson attacks since July 8th. "Now we've had this tragic fire a block down this way," he said, pointing toward the East 2nd Street house. "And in early March, the arsonist burned the old business, a former grocery store, about a block that way," he said, indicating the business address on Cedar Street. "With the arsons going on and everything, it's just kind of spooky, and they haven't caught the arsonist yet. It does make you nervous." The cause of the East 2nd Street fatal fire remains under an investigation involving Pena firefighters, Pena police, the state fire marshal's office, and the Christian County coroner's office. Pena Fire Chief Rod Bland said the cause was undetermined, but might have been electrical in nature. He said the arsonist had only struck at buildings that had often been left empty for some time, not occupied family homes. Bland, who only lives a few blocks away and had arrived on scene shortly after the police patrolman, had seen the officer put a ladder up to the window and break through in his attempt to reach the trapped children. "But the smoke and the heat were just so heavy, there was no way to make entry, Bland said. "I got my fire gear on and tried to make entry into the front door, and there was just no way. Too much smoke and too much heat. There was just no way of getting in." His firefighters were on scene within minutes, and fearing for the children, attempted a rescue while wearing breathing apparatus. "But the fire busted out. It come through the roof in the back and everything, and we just had to pull them, the firefighters, out and get that fire under control," Bland added. Bland said it took around 20 minutes to knock the fire down to where firefighters could safely get back inside, and that is when they found both bodies upstairs in the smoldering remains of the burned-out upper story. The fire chief, who has been with the Pena department for 40 years, says a tragedy like this scars everybody involved, not least his own firefighters. He said his department had mutual aid help from the fire departments in Tower Hill, Oconee, Nokomis, and Assumption, and there were a lot of young firefighters coming face to face with intense tragedy. "We are calling in a critical debriefing team to help them deal with all this," Bland added. "We are going to make sure everybody is okay." As for the work of his firefighters, the chief said he was heartened and humbled by the sheer intensity of their efforts to save those children. "They went well above and beyond trying to make entry into that house," he added. They worked their tails off trying to make this a successful rescue happen, and it just wasn't going to happen this time. Brandy West lives in a large, century-old two-story home close to the fire scene, and is friends with the family that lived there. She described the father as a good man who works his butt off to take care of his kids. She said the nightmare that has befallen his family should make everybody think twice about their own fire safety. My house is old, and we've got that old electrical wiring, and we've been doing some rewiring, trying to make updates, she said. Now I just want to get a lot more smoke detectors. And there are some photographs that accompany this article. The first, painted fire chief Rod Bland takes some notes outside the scene of Sunday's fire, in which a baby and toddler died. The cause of the fire has yet to be determined. And then a sad photograph showing kids' toys laying scattered amid the fire debris in the aftermath of the tragedy. And finally, a photograph of the burned building with broken windows. Heat and smoke from a fire Sunday morning at 808 East 2nd Street in Pena was so intense that it prevented a family member, police, and firefighters from gaining access to the second story, where the bodies of the two children were later found. Pictured is the burned-out upper story of the home. And also from the front page, the Herald and Review launches a new podcast. The Herald and Review returns to podcasting today with Herald and Review Voices. The Voices podcast features conversations with Herald and Review writers, editors, and our readers. The initial effort features staff writer Justin Kahn. Kahn discusses how his work on a story about a woman's search for her roots sparked interest in his own genealogy. As it happens with anyone tracing their ancestry, Kahn has had his successes and failures, and talks about them. The podcast is designed to enable Central Illinois residents a chance to tell a story, lending their words to the area's collective experience. Current plans for the podcast to appear weekly on Mondays. To suggest a subject or individual to be a Herald and Review voice, reach us by email, hrnews@herald-review.com, via Facebook, facebook.com/heraldandreview, it's facebook.com/heraldandreview, or by phone at 217-421-6908. The audience engagement editor is Tim Kane. And the final story from the front page today is St. Louis welcomes Cubs season with celebration. From St. Louis, a man in a St. Louis Cardinals-themed Spider-Man outfit could be found posing for photos with beer drinkers at 11:30 a.m. Sunday on Clark Avenue. His partner, wearing a red bird emblazoned Iron Man suit, waited patiently a few feet away. Fast approaching, striding beneath a black top hat, came a spitting image of Abraham Lincoln. And Claire Thomas was the one who stood out. The psychologist from Plymouth, England, was wandering around outside of Busch Stadium, wearing a puzzled look on her face. Her polka dot dress included neither cardinal red nor cubby blue. She explained she was in town for business starting today and made it clear she did not know what to make of this display. Yes, she had been to the United States before, but never to St. Louis, never on an opening night. "I had no idea," she said. "I turned up in the Uber and there were a million people in red tops." No, she wasn't kidding. Seemingly the only person in downtown St. Louis for a reason other than the Cardinals' much-anticipated season opener against their biggest rival, had been dropped off at the Crown Plaza with just one warning about the chaos she would encounter. "You must be here for the game," the Uber driver told her. "What game?" she asked. "What game?" he gasped. "Where would you begin?" Which would you describe first? The parade of Fords, eight Clydesdales clomping, the goose pimples that accompany the season's first rendition of Here Comes the King? Would you walk her to the corner and introduce her to the men in bronze? Here's leaning Bob Gibson, diving Ozzie Smith, and jumping Red Schoendienst. Stick around and you can see them in the flesh. Some heroes wear red coats instead of capes. Would you walk her to the Musial statue? Claire Thomas, here stands the man. For so many, seeing him on opening day was the moment. He's gone now, but not really. His name is on the street sign over there. He's on the back of that man's shirt. And his son's. Listen to Take Me Out to the Ball Game and try not to hear his harmonica. How would Bill DeWitt Jr. explain it? It's clearly a major holiday in St. Louis, and everyone treats it that way, the Cardinals chairman said during Sunday's batting practice, as 11 World Series pennants rippled in the breeze. It's a celebration of a great history of the Cardinals. Everyone is anticipating the season. It's something families look forward to. It's just a special day. Sunday, even more so. The Cardinals started their 125th anniversary season both at night and at home, something that had not happened since 2008, and that's only if you count a rescheduled night game that occurred after a previous day's opener was rained out. And it just so happened that the evening's opponent was the curse-breaking Chicago Cubs, the first defending World Series champion the Cardinals have hosted in a home opener for 36 years. As soon as a once dormant rivalry found new life, the Cardinals found themselves on the opposite side. It just makes it more interesting, don't you think? Cubs fan Rebecca Hennessy said before entering Busch, a not-so-subtle jab at her husband, who was wearing a Cardinals shirt. Kevin Hennessy disagreed. Yeah, whatever, said his wife. He knows who cooks his food. They laughed and shared their story. High school sweethearts from Nebraska who drifted apart, started their own families, got divorced, and discovered one another again. They call Iowa home now and made the road trip here for a celebration. It was his 60th birthday and their 6th wedding anniversary. It was like we had never been apart, she said. Same goes for St. Louis and baseball. It's why Lee Hannell and Ron McClanahan hauled a grill big enough for 80 burgers to a downtown parking lot at 8:30 a.m. They didn't know whether they would wind up soaked or sunburned, and they didn't care. Their three-tent setup had a satellite dish, a Johnny on the spot, and all the bratwursts you could suck down. Summer is here, Hannell said. Everybody is coming out of their cocoons. It's a celebration. People are always in a good mood. Game One does more than recognize and remember the legends. It represents a fresh start. How would you explain that to Claire Thomas? There's this guy named Dexter Fowler, and he's playing his first game as a Cardinal. After winning a title with the Cubs last season, he homered in Game 7. The Northsiders hadn't won a title since 1908. You've got to turn the page, Fowler said, and they do too. There's Yadier Molina, the best defensive catcher of his generation. He's going to be a Cardinal for life, the team just announced. Only Musial and Lou Brock have started more consecutive season openers. He, too, will be in bronze one day. And before he lifted his cap to a roar, he anticipated the embrace he will never have to leave. This is a dream come true, Molina said. Now, he's not as famous, but you have to hear about Jose Martinez. The 28-year-old outfielder spent a decade in the minor leagues before experiencing his first opening day. In Venezuela, a household of his family members, uncles, grandparents, cousins, his mother, and 3-year-old son crowded around a TV to watch this game. I don't care if it's at night, if it's on Tuesday, Wednesday, Sunday, whatever, Martinez said. Any day is fine with me. The important thing is, man, just enjoy the moment. Cubs, game at night. But for me, it's just one thing. I'm going to be where I want to be for a long time. I'm just going to enjoy that moment from the bottom of my heart. Would that capture it? Would any story? DeWitt was amused to learn about the English psychologist who stumbled into a case study on fandom. Maybe she'll become a fan, he hoped. She would need to learn the rules, she had admitted earlier. The passion she witnessed did not need to be explained. It's insane, she said. This makes football fans in England look a bit lame. And the photographs accompanying this article show a Cubs fan leaning against a street sign. Chicago Cubs fan Brian Rhodes leans against a post outside Busch Stadium before a baseball game between the St. Louis Cardinals and the Cubs on opening day Sunday. And the next photograph shows stands full of spectators and a full complement of the giant Clydesdales. Budweiser Clydesdales make their way around the Busch Stadium field as part of opening night festivities before a baseball game between the St. Louis Cardinals and the Chicago Cubs. And we'll move to the local page, starting with an article from Decatur. City plans to shift $2 million in Brush College overpass funding. The Decatur City Council will decide today whether to reallocate more than $2 million toward a different aspect of the Brush College Road Ferries Parkway project. The plan would move the grant money received through the Illinois Jobs Now program toward the purchase of rights-of-way for the road project. The hope is the reallocation and focus on the project will aid in future attempts to acquire federal funding. The council meets at 5:30 p.m. today in the council chambers in the Decatur Civic Center. The just over $2 million had previously been earmarked to cover final design plans and putting out to bid for work at the Brush College Road Bridge over the Norfolk Southern Rail Yard south of Ferries Parkway. The reallocation comes after the city was turned down last summer for a $20 million federal grant that would have gone toward the project. After consulting with the U.S. Department of Transportation, city officials said they were told the project was not far enough along to compete against other applicants for grant dollars. City Manager Tim Gleason said talks with the Illinois Department of Transportation revealed the city could reallocate the previously received state dollars toward the project as long as the agreement to use the $2 million for design work was canceled. It's just a shifting of priorities. We feel the money could better be spent currently on this project, Gleason said. Our priority is the Eastern Beltway and the things that are related to that and can help us be successful in getting some major federal funding. The Beltway, which has been discussed for more than a decade, would eventually connect Interstate 72 and US 51 via improved roads and bridges that would take traffic around Decatur and Mount Zion. The Beltway is seen as a way to provide jobs and a boost to the local economy as it aids economic development efforts. In other business, the council is set to approve a contract for the mowing and weed removal from lots owned by the Macon County Trustee after the failed code violations. Eight companies have placed bids for the work, which covers 21 districts, each with anywhere from 11 to 63 lots in need of maintenance. The properties that are covered are those that have either been abandoned or vacant. Gleason called the situations unfortunate for all parties. It's unfortunate, but we're put in a position where we're forced to address it, he said. But you have neighbors and neighborhoods that deserve better than having people leaving their property and leaving the burden with the city. And from Peoria, Tony Reed writes, Peoria locals vote saves $3,000 union bonus. United Auto Workers Local 974 in Peoria voted to accept Caterpillar Inc.'s later contract offer on Saturday, and now the $3,000 a head bonus promised to all union workers is safe. Caterpillar workers in Decatur, members of Local 751, had voted along with a majority of UAW members a week earlier to ratify the offer, but were dismayed to discover the $3,000 bonus hinged on every local voting yes. Local 974 had voted to reject by a 55-45% margin, and Local 751 told its members the UAW leadership was prepared to go back to the bargaining table to try and save the bonus if the Peoria workers again voted no a second time. But their re-vote on Saturday showed a remarkable turnaround. The margin to approve swung to 94%. In a statement on its Facebook page, Local 751 told members their Peoria colleagues had now overwhelmingly ratified their local agreement. This is the final step in the ratification process of the recent round of UAW Caterpillar collective bargaining agreements. And in its own statement following the vote, Caterpillar confirmed the $3,000 bonuses would be paid. "We are pleased that our employees in the Peoria area voted in favor of the new agreement," said John Ginzel, Caterpillar Director of Labor Relations. "It's a good agreement that recognizes the contributions of our employees while keeping the company competitive in a global marketplace. As a further recognition of our employees' contributions, we've decided to grant the $3,000 ratification bonus." The new 6-year Caterpillar UAW agreement on wages and benefits covers 5,000 employees across 11 facilities in Illinois and Pennsylvania. And moving now to the opinion page, the opinion piece by the Herald and Review. "Our opinion, this is the time to consider legalizing pot. You know the Illinois budget mess is bad when they start eyeing making recreational pot legal. But that's what's happening in Springfield, and we think it's actually not a half-baked idea." State Representative Kelly Cassidy, Democrat from Chicago, introduced legislation that would allow those 21 and over to possess, purchase, or grow up to an ounce of marijuana. Licensed businesses also would be able to sell cannabis and related products subject to regulation. The plan would bring Illinois in line with Colorado and Oregon, two of 8 states that have liberal policies on the drug. What those states don't have is anything near the 2-year fiscal morass of our fine state, home to the lengthiest budget deficit in the nation. And that's why the pot plan may help. Oregon last year generated $60 million from marijuana taxes. Colorado got $140 million. Cassidy, who in 2014 co-sponsored legislation that legalized medical marijuana, estimates Illinois could make up to $700 million annually. That would make a small dent in the state's $9.6 billion budget gap, but it's not the only reason we see value in lifting rules on the drug. Put simply, it's time to examine draconian cannabis laws, a holdover from the zero-tolerance war on drugs era that contributed to overpopulated prisons and numerous social problems that linger today. It's time to be realistic about marijuana and its users, including those who need it for medical reasons. 17 other states are considering similar plans related to recreational pot. In our view, the legislation is reasonable because it allows a small amount of the drug and prohibits marijuana use in public places and in moving vehicles. And, like alcohol, it's taxed and limited to those over 21. Lawmakers last year passed legislation decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of pot, which remains illegal at the federal level. this new measure continues the trend, but it faces strong resistance. The Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police has been critical of it, and every other state that's legalized marijuana has done it by ballot initiative. Despite the opposition, we think this is time to have a conversation about drug policy in Illinois. And one of the opinion columns from the opinion page by Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. Clarence Page, is there a populist counter-movement? Phew, that was close. I wasn't expecting to be waiting on the edge of my seat for the outcome of this year's Dutch parliamentary elections, but I wasn't expecting Donald Trump to be America's president either. After Brexit, Great Britain's vote last year to leave the European Union, and Trump's upset election victory, the whole world has been watching to see whether a wave of anti-immigrant, populist upsets would win a trifecta in the Netherlands and keep rolling through upcoming elections in France, Germany, and other European elections. In the Netherlands, that movement's champion in parliamentary elections was anti-Muslim firebrand Geert Wilders, a Trump fan with similarly interesting hair and xenophobic attitudes toward immigrants and refugees. To give you an idea of where he stands politically by American standards, one of our own prominent xenophobes, Representative Steve King, an Iowa Republican, gave Wilders a shout-out on Twitter as one who understands that culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. The backlash against King's remarks was bipartisan. Among King's Republican critics, for example, Representative Carlos Curbelo of Florida, a child of Cuban immigrants, immediately tweeted back, "Do I qualify as somebody else's baby?" But King also won praise from David Duke, the former KKK leader and former Republican Louisiana gubernatorial nominee, praised King's tweet as proof that sanity reigns supreme in King's Northwest Iowa congressional district. And King doesn't sound far removed from Wilders, who is known for such comments as, "I don't hate Muslims, I hate Islam." And Islam is not a religion, it's an ideology, the ideology of a retarded culture. And Wilders sounds mightily close to the sentiments of long-experienced French anti-immigrant leader Marine Le Pen. She has been showing higher approval numbers than ever in the run-up to the presidential elections in May, in which she is campaigning for a French exit from the EU. And Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel faces tough challenges in September elections from the right over her generous policies toward refugees. Against that backdrop, Holland's record-high turnout that left Wilders in second place offered a hopeful sign that the momentum of Le Pen and others might be stalled and even pushed back. Significantly, a number of experts are saying the chaos and confusion that followed Brexit and the rise of Trump's unorthodox regime may have alarmed Dutch voters enough to raise a counter-movement against radical populist change, at least for now. Can we all get along? Until Trump's upset victory, we Americans usually provided a better model of how vastly diverse society can work, despite our periodic clashes over race, and ethnicity. Unlike Europe, our identity as Americans is not tied to our ancestral identity, regardless of what kind of outlandish ideas Representative King might have about who is a real American. Yet as much as we call ourselves a nation of immigrants, we are also a nation of immigrant debates. The populist rise in the Netherlands gave a wake-up call to the sensible political center, but traditional politicians in Europe and America can't afford to hit the snooze button. They need to offer better alternatives to those who feel displaced and left behind by industrial and geopolitical change. And this is the end of our first half hour. On April 3rd, 2017, we will take a short break now and return with our second half of today's reading from the Decatur Herald and Review. Stay tuned.